Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. A West Coast port slowdown over a labor dispute has gotten the attention of President Obama, and we'll have details on today's show. Also in Washington, the FAA has announced proposed new rules to regulate drones. Hear how that could impact the airways across America and the economy here in our community. Republicans in Congress are threatening to shut down the Department of Homeland Security on February 27th. Find out why on our Capitol Report. Why did Supervisor Dave Roberts cast a vote for Soitec's controversial industrial solar projects in East County without disclosing or recusing himself when just 1 week later, major Soitec backers held a fundraiser for him? Now some residents in East County are asking just whose interests Supervisor Roberts was representing. And then on Crime Beat, hear about a brazen robbery at a jewelry store in a regional shopping mall in East County. As the measles outbreak spreads, a debate is also raging on vaccinations. We'll have a report for you today examining the safety of measles vaccines and statistics on how many cases of brain damage and deaths have been prevented by the vaccine, and these numbers may surprise you. We have some heartbreaking news about a toddler in Alpine who's been battling neuroblastoma cancer. But we also have heartwarming news about East County residents turning out at a benefit in La Mesa to help a local firefighter in need of a heart transplant. The County Medical Examiner's Office has issued a warning about some frightening new drugs turning up in our region that are killing young people, including one that is 10 times stronger than heroin. Some are being found in the U.S. for the first time right here in San Diego by tests done by our Medical Examiner's Office. So be sure to stay tuned for details on what you need to know to stay safe and keep your children safe. We'll also have news about some free flights being offered by an airline to help patients and caregivers in need of medical care. Then on the second half of our show, we'll be replaying some Best of East County favorites today, starting with our newsmaker interview with Sullivan Solar about big changes happening in the solar marketplace in California, including some major incentives for rooftop solar that may soon be going away. On Tribal Beat, hear about the first ever powwow held at Cuyamaca College. And on Sounds of History, listen to Dick Panic with the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campo talking about his experiences as a brakeman riding the rails for many years. Plus, learn how you can nominate a deserving young person for El Cajon's Youth of the Year Awards. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, because East County matters.
A labor dispute is causing slowdowns in ports along the West Coast. Now, President Barack Obama has announced he is sending his labor secretary, Tom Perez, to California to meet with both sides and try to negotiate a settlement. Dozens of ships are waiting offshore at ports from California to Washington State. Employers claim workers have intentionally slowed down offloading cargo, an accusation denied by the union. Now, some employers are locking out dock workers, making it impossible to offload cargo, Associated Press reports. Meanwhile, losses are piling up, particularly for producers of perishable goods, such as California's growers of citrus and other agricultural crops. USA Today reports the American meat industry estimates $30 million a week in losses are occurring for meat and poultry producers. The dock workers' contract expired back on June 30th last year, but contract negotiations since then have stalled. A key bone of contention is over efforts by management to outsource jobs inspecting tractor-trailer chassis used to move cargo containers. Automation that could replace jobs is another concern of the union. A full-fledged strike could shut down ports altogether, a situation that occurred for 10 days back in 2002 when President George W. Bush used his power under the Taft-Hartley Act to force ports to reopen. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
The Federal Aviation Administration has released draft rules for regulating drones, though it will likely take 2 years or more before they can take effect. The next step will be approval by the Obama administration, followed by a public comment period. The rules are favorable to opening up the skyways for commercial use of drones for applications such as inspecting bridges and cell phone towers, agricultural and photographic purposes. But there are strict limits proposed. Drones must be under 55 pounds and cannot fly over 500 feet to minimize risks to aircraft. They can't fly at night, and operators must be able to see the drones at all times, so you won't be seeing drones delivering pizzas or merchandise for companies such as Amazon.com. Nor will you see crop spraying by drones, which would require larger size drones than the regulations allow. However, farmers could use drones to monitor their crops. The regulations also open the door for drones to be used by news organizations within the guidelines provided, potentially allowing aerial coverage of breaking news, natural disasters, and more. There are many advantages, but also many disadvantages to the widespread use of drones. One clear advantage is that drones can save lives. For instance, CBS reports that from 2004 to 2012, 95 workers were killed climbing cell phone towers and other towers. Many such deaths could be prevented by using drones to inspect communications equipment, bridges, and other risky places. But drones also pose risks from a security standpoint, as a drone that went astray on the White House lawn recently pointed out. Plus, there have been numerous near misses involving drones and airplanes, prompting calls for the FAA to move quickly on imposing regulations. Drones also pose challenges to law enforcement, as evidenced by the crash of a drug-smuggling drone at San Ysidro recently. Privacy advocates have also raised concerns about paparazzi and spying on ordinary citizens. Now an enterprising website, noflyzone.org, is offering a free service to declare the airspace over your house or other private property as a no-fly zone. It only applies to drone manufacturers who are willing to voluntarily comply, but some manufacturers are doing that with GPS technology to prevent drones from flying over properties designated as no-fly zones. That address, again, is noflyzone.org. The Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, which represents the drone industry, has estimated that small commercial drones could create 70,000 jobs and pump over $13 billion into the economy in just the first 3 years. While that is a substantial sum, it could be partially offset if some jobs are lost to the automated drones. As a hub for drone manufacturing, San Diego is among the regions set to benefit financially from increased use of drones. Drone operators will be required to take an aerospace knowledge test through the FAA at a cost of about $300, but they will not have to get a pilot license. A security check of operators would also be conducted prior to issuing a certificate to operate a drone. Reporting for East County Magazine from the Drone Zone here in San Diego, this is Miriam Raftery. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Leon Thompson with the Capitol Report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. Conservatives in Congress are threatening to let the Department of Homeland Security shut down on February 27th, refusing to fund a measure authorizing funding of Homeland Security unless they can secure approval of language to repeal President Obama's executive orders on immigration. The agency was formed to protect national security after the 9/11 terrorism attacks in 2001. The president's orders halted deportation proceedings for millions of undocumented immigrants who are not felons and who have close family members who are citizens or legal residents, seeking to keep families together. The House passed a measure that would repeal those reforms, but it has been blocked in the Senate, and the president has said he would veto it if it passed. If Republicans force a showdown of Homeland Security, many workers will still remain on the job, but without pay, such as Border Patrol agents and Transportation Security Administration employees. In an era of mounting terrorism concerns, critics contend that any lapse in national security could have serious consequences. But staunch conservatives contend that standing on their principles is worth the risk. Speaker John Boehner told Fox News Sunday that he is ready to let funding for Homeland Security lapse. He blamed Senate Democrats, adding, "We've done our job." Not all Republicans agree. Arizona Senator John McCain voiced alarm over the situation on Meet the Press. He insists, "You cannot cut funding from the Department of Homeland Security. We need to sit down and work this thing out." Democratic leaders have blasted the GOP majority stance. Democrat Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader, said in a press briefing last week, House Republicans refused to admit the dangerous collapse of their anti-immigration grandstand. Republicans should stop holding their Homeland Security hostage and bring forward a clean, long-term funding bill immediately. Just how voters may respond at the ballot box to Republicans holding Homeland Security funding hostage over immigration issues remains to be seen.
Just 1 week after Supervisor Dave Roberts voted to approve the highly controversial Soytech industrial-scale solar projects in Boulevard, a fundraiser for his campaign was held at the La Jolla home of Jim Waring, co-founder of Cleantech San Diego. Waring lobbied and testified on behalf of Soytech's projects. The Roberts fundraiser was also co-sponsored by Jim Whalen, whose firm, J. Whalen & Associates, represents Hammond Companies. Hammond owns the land on which one of Soytech's projects is slated to be built in Boulevard. Whalen also represents Sempra Energy, parent organization of SDG&E, which could ultimately profit off the projects through future power purchase agreements. These cozy ties raise a serious question. Just how impartial was Roberts when casting a vote to scrape bare over 1,100 acres of wildlife habitat in East County, including land along a scenic highway surrounding homes with thousands of solar panels each 30 feet high by 48 feet wide? Water needed for construction of these projects could put the town's water supply at risk, two hydrologists have warned. Supervisor Diane Jacob has warned that the projects also create an unmitigatable fire risk, according to the Environmental Impact Report. Now Boulevard residents want to know just whose interests Roberts was representing. Was this fundraiser planned before the vote, with Roberts knowing full well he'd be raking in thousands of dollars from the efforts of individuals testifying before the board on behalf of Soytech? And if so, why didn't he recuse himself or even disclose an apparent conflict of interest when the Soytech project came up for a vote? Roberts' district does not include rural Boulevard. Boulevard residents are largely poor. They don't have the money to host lavish fundraisers for politicians. They can't even vote for those who are casting the votes to destroy their way of life and the natural settings they moved out there to enjoy. Their representative, Supervisor Diane Jacob, did vote against the Soytech projects. But the four supervisors from other districts pushed it through over her objections. The vast majority of Boulevard residents oppose Soytech's projects based on turnout at community meetings, comments sent to the county, and testimony made to the supervisors. They do support renewable energy, on rooftops, not by paving over our backcountry wetlands and meadows. The same power could be obtained through rooftop solar, but California's convoluted law does not allow rooftop solar to count toward the renewable mandates that our state has set, as Roberts himself has noted. Instead of voting to protect the environment and working to change state mandates, however, Roberts cast a vote for environmental devastation, justifying it as respecting the, quote, property rights, unquote, of those who own the land to be developed into industrial solar, including a property owner whose lobbyist hosted a fundraiser at his private home to benefit Roberts' campaign. State law is clear, according to the Fair Political Practices Commission. Elected officials have a duty to protect the public interest, not special interests to whom they are financially beholden. The FPPC says it has referred the question of Roberts' actions to its enforcement division to determine whether or not he violated state election law. But he most certainly violated the public trust by failing to disclose his financial ties to the Soytech project backers, or better yet, recusing himself from the vote to avoid any appearance of a conflict of interest. Boulevard Planning Group Chair Donna Tisdale, who is also the founder of a citizens group called Backcountry Against Dumps, called Roberts' actions distressing. She voiced disappointment and disgust to learn of the fundraiser held for Roberts by Soytech backers. Tisdale also told East County Magazine that to protect rural residents and non-renewable resources that Soytech's projects will destroy, the nonprofit Backcountry Against Dumps, or BAD, is preparing to file a lawsuit, challenging what Tisdale calls the county's misguided and ethically challenged Soytech approvals. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat Report. An armed gunman robbed Westfield Jewelers in the Parkway Plaza shopping mall in El Cajon Wednesday night. According to Sergeant MacArthur with the El Cajon Police, the suspect pretended to be a customer interested in purchasing rings. When the employee began showing jewelry, the suspect brandished a firearm and grabbed merchandise from the display case. The suspect has not been found. He is described as a black male adult, short, with a thin build. He is approximately 5'1" or 5'2" tall. He wore a black hat, black jacket, and dark pants. He was last seen exiting the mall through the north doors towards Fletcher Parkway. It is unknown whether he fled in a car or on foot. The exact losses are still being determined as the investigation continues. Anyone with additional information is encouraged to call the El Cajon Police Department at 619-579-3311. Individuals with information about these cases who wish to remain anonymous can call the Crime Stoppers tip line at 888-580-8477.
More than 113 measles cases have now been reported in California, many of those right here in San Diego County and East County. A debate is raging over whether or not measles vaccines should be mandatory, with some doctors refusing to treat unvaccinated patients, some schools refusing to allow unvaccinated children, and legislation working its way through the legislature to get rid of the personal choice exemption. So just how dangerous are measles cases? Well, the benefit of measles vaccination in preventing illness, disability, and death has been well documented. The first 20 years of licensed measles vaccinations in the United States prevented an estimated 52 million cases of the disease, including 17,400 cases of brain damage and 5,200 deaths, and that's according to a pediatric study published in PubMed. In other words, for every death, more than three times that many cases of brain damage occurred. Those figures don't include other permanent debilitating impacts of measles, such as blindness, deafness, or neurological damage. One local doctor told me that he remembers a patient here, David Nelson, who was left with cerebral palsy as a result of measles, and he now gives local talks on why he thinks it's important to receive the measles vaccine. From 1999 to 2004, a strategy led by the World Health Organization and UNICEF resulted in improvements in measles vaccines that averted an estimated 1.4 million measles deaths worldwide, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Between 2000 and 2013, measles vaccination resulted in a 75% decrease in deaths worldwide from the disease, according to the World Health Organization's measles fact sheet. Some parents have resisted vaccinating their children, in part due to a report that seemed to show a link between vaccinations and autism some years ago. But that claim has been strongly debunked since then, with evidence that the principal author actually stood to benefit financially having invested in an alternative treatment for measles. Later studies showed just the opposite, finding no link between vaccines and autism. The World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control, and other credible organizations have all concluded that there is no credible evidence linking autism to vaccines, and further, that any risk from vaccinations is far less than the risk posed by diseases such as measles, mumps, or polio for those who are not vaccinated. Now this month, even the Autism Science Foundation has come out with a statement on this issue. The Autism Science Foundation says that a decade ago, it believed vaccine safety did need more study because autism rates were rising at the same time childhood vaccinations were increasing. But was there really a connection? Here's what the Autism Science Foundation has concluded. Fortunately, this was a question that could be studied and answered by science. We looked at children who received vaccines and those who didn't, or who received them on a different, slower schedule. There was no difference in their neurological outcomes. Multiple studies have been completed which investigated the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination in relation to autism. Researchers have also studied thimerosal, a mercury-based preservative, to see if it had any relation to autism. The results of the studies are very clear. The data shows no relationship between vaccines and autism, the Autism Science Foundation concludes. Now, if you're still not sure, you can read the actual studies, along with the recommended reading on the Autism Science Foundation's website at autismsciencefoundation.org/autismandvaccines.html. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with some sad news about a toddler who captured the hearts of a community and has now died after a long battle with neuroblastoma cancer. A memorial service was held on Valentine's Day for Kylie Rowland of Alpine, with hundreds of mourners dressed in pink at Shadow Mountain Church in El Cajon. During the past year, Alpine residents held fundraisers and prayer vigils, displaying pink ribbons throughout the town to show support for Kylie and her parents, Luke and Bree. A Facebook page set up for Kylie drew over 100,000 friends. Kylie was diagnosed with cancer at 19 months of age and underwent extensive treatments in an effort to save her life. Alpine Sun editor Lori Bledsoe offered these touching words in memory of Kylie. Kylie will always be a symbol of love and perseverance, even through the greatest pain, she wrote. A shared caring that connected almost 100,000 people came into being, and awareness has grown for the love of this child. Kylie, Alpine will never know what you could have accomplished in a long life, but we know that in your short time here on Earth, you brought a community to their knees. Sunday, February 15th, was International Childhood Cancer Day, ironically. If you would like to donate to help Kylie's family with their medical bills, you can do so at prayersforkylie.com, and that's spelled K-Y-L-I-E, prayersforkylie.com.
Bolt Brewery in La Mesa hosted a fundraiser last weekend to help Adam Beardsley, a 33-year-old Heartland deputy fire marshal in need of a heart transplant. Monica Zek, public information officer for the city of El Cajon, was among those who attended. She says Beardsley has a big heart, not only for protecting the community in his daily job, but Beardsley also volunteers in his spare time at the Burn Institute. Since January 6, Beardsley has been a patient at the UCLA Ronald Reagan Hospital while awaiting a heart donor. Zek says that despite his ordeal, Beardsley remains in good spirits. As for the fundraiser, she says Beardsley didn't want this to be just about him, adding that Beardsley hopes publicity on the shortage of organ donors will ultimately help others too. A single organ donor can save the lives of up to 8 people. Currently, over 110,000 people in the United States are on a waiting list for an organ transplant. Nearly 1,600 people are on the waiting list for an organ transplant in San Diego and Imperial counties. For information about organ donation, you can visit lifesharing.org. Beardsley was born with a congenital heart condition, but in January, doctors found that pulmonary embolisms have weakened his heart, so a transplant is needed to save his life. His wife, Megan, commutes from her job at San Diego State University to visit him on weekends, taking on added expenses to rent an apartment close to the hospital. His sister and parents also have been traveling to Los Angeles, making sure a family member is with him at all times while he awaits the life-saving call that a donor has been found. Clint Stromberg, co-owner of Bolt Brewery, says he met Beardsley several times while preparing to open the brewery in La Mesa. He's one of the nicest and most genuine people I know. He gives back a lot to the community, said Stromberg, who adds, "The firemen really support each other. They are super cool guys," says Stromberg, who made a pretty cool move himself. His brewery donated 50% of all proceeds from the fundraiser to help Beardsley and his family. Hundreds of community members came to the benefit event, providing a heartwarming response to help a young firefighter and his family. An online site has been set up to collect additional donations at GoFundMe.com/Beardsley. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert from the County of San Diego. Powerful new drugs are killing San Diegans, the County Medical Examiner's Office warns. The victims were young, all ranging in age from their late teens to their 20s. Last November, a 24-year-old San Diego County man bought and injected what he thought was heroin. Instead, it was a synthetic drug 10 times more powerful, and he died from the accidental overdose. The drug turned out to be acetylfentanyl, and it was the first time the County Medical Examiner's Office identified that substance as the cause of a fatal overdose in San Diego County. Additionally, in the past year, medical examiner staff detected 5 other new synthetic drug compounds during death investigations. None had been seen in local deaths before, and 3 had never been identified in forensic autopsies anywhere in the United States. The spate of new substances is worrisome to Ian McIntyre, the medical examiner's forensic toxicology laboratory manager. Dr. McIntyre warns, the last year has been quite surprising, picking up a rash of unusual drugs, new compounds. There are a lot of novel drug compounds being used in San Diego County, and these synthetic drugs have dubious purity. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime calls these synthetic drugs new psychoactive substances. 2 are bath salt-type stimulants. 2 others are psychedelic hallucinogenic compounds, and 1 of them is similar to PCP. 2 more, including acetylfentanyl, are opioids, similar to heroin. In the acetylfentanyl case, and in another involving a new compound called 5-APB, which is similar to bath salts but chemically based on ecstasy, the drugs were cited as the direct cause of death. In autopsies involving the 4 other synthetic drugs, the compounds contributed to the deaths. McIntyre said the acetylfentanyl concerns him most because it may be sold in place of heroin and has led to clusters of deaths in other parts of the country. Acetylfentanyl was first identified in a series of deaths in Rhode Island and then in several fatal overdoses in the Carolinas. McIntyre said San Diego toxicologists were the first to measure the fatal toxicity concentration levels. He suspects that local hospital emergency room workers have already seen the substance but may not have known it, because users' symptoms resemble those in heroin overdoses. The treatments are similar, but acetylfentanyl requires much more antidote because of its increased potency. McIntyre is not certain, but he believes that acetylfentanyl may have been purchased locally based on when it's believed the victim obtained the drug. But many of the other new psychoactive substances are believed to have been purchased online, creating potentially more uncertainty. Dr. McIntyre warns, "The problem is when you buy these drugs on the Internet, you don't know exactly what you're getting. You don't know if it's mixed with something that is more toxic than you think you're taking, and you don't know the purity of it, or if the drug you buy today on the Internet might be stronger than the one you bought last month, and you get a toxic, fatal reaction to it. The Internet is a game changer with these synthetic, modern abuse drugs," he says. William Perno, a prevention specialist with the Institute for Public Strategies and a retired San Diego County Sheriff's deputy, says synthetic drug makers often alter drug compounds to stay one step ahead of authorities who ban specific synthetic drug formulas. A manufacturer knows that a product may be out in the market 6 months or a year before it's flagged as a dangerous drug, so they're already working on their next formula. Perno cautions, "This is chemical Russian roulette. The effects can be death or serious injury after just one-time use." Local drug dealers can be fooled by their drug sources, too. According to Perno, one North County man who was a known ecstasy dealer was actually selling bath salts or methylone to his own surprise. The county's toxicology laboratory identified methylone to be yet another new synthetic substance that caused a death in a 2013 case. Perno says some recreational drug users think they are smoking all-natural herbs and don't realize the herbs are sprayed with psychoactive substances because these drugs aren't listed on packaging. The Medical Examiner's Office has published its findings and methodology on 5 of these 7 drugs in National Toxicology and Forensic Science journals. Often, these new psychoactive substances aren't even tested for in autopsies and other areas because not all medical examiners or morgues have a laboratory. Their toxicology tests are conducted at independent contract laboratories. New psychoactive substances may not even register on some routine panels that labs are using for drug testing. San Diego County's Medical Examiner's Office tests for 12 different categories of commonly abused drugs, and other areas may test for only 5 or 6. Here in San Diego, many of the new psychoactive drugs were initially detected when they triggered a reaction for one of the drugs on the routine screening panel. However, upon subsequent confirmation testing, the sample didn't contain any of the expected drugs, and this is what tipped off toxicologists to the possibility of another new psychoactive substance, which they then set out to confirm and measure. As it turns out, some of the newer synthetic drugs produce a positive result on routine screening tests because their chemical structures are similar. Dr. McIntyre concludes, "As our chief medical examiner, Dr. Glenn Wagner, often says, we're not just the local morgue. We want to be an education source and a research center." He adds that the Forensic Toxicology Laboratory is important to help educate not only scientists, but also local communities about the dangers of the drugs out there, particularly those that people can get now on the Internet. These substances can result in more than a high. Some can lead to a one-way trip to the county morgue.
Southwest Airlines announced Tuesday that it will provide over $3.2 million in free transportation to patients seeking medical treatment and to their caregivers. Grants will be made through Southwest's Medical Transportation Grant Program, which will oversee a 14% increase over last year. Through the program, participating nonprofit hospitals and medical programs provide complimentary round-trip airline tickets to families who need to travel for specialized medical care. Receiving world-class medical attention is more attainable when the cost of travel is not an issue. This year, the program will impact 75 nonprofit hospitals and medical organizations, reaching a total of 101 medical facilities nationwide. This year's list includes Rady Children's Hospital and Scripps Health here in San Diego County. For a full list of 2015 participants, visit www.southwest.com/medical-grant. Linda Rutherford, Southwest Airlines Vice President of Communications and Outreach, says, "We are proud to help fill the gap between where patients live and where the doctors they need practice, so patients can receive the treatment that best supports them." To learn about qualifications for travel assistance through the designated organizations, please contact your medical facility. For more information on Southwest, you can visit southwest.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Today, we're going to be talking about a hot topic, and that is solar energy. My special guest today is Erica Johnson, who is the Director of Community Relations at Sullivan Solar Power. Sullivan is the largest installer of solar locally per the California Solar Initiative. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Miriam.
Now, you're here to talk today about some monumental changes that are taking places in the solar market. You're telling us that the year 2015 is going to be the largest surge in demand the region has ever seen in what's being referred to as the solar gold rush of 2015. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, actually, there's a couple big policy changes that are going to be taking place both on the statewide level, especially here locally in the SDG&E territory, and then also on the national level.
And what are those changes?
The first is the rules of solar as we currently know them are changing in the state of California. So currently, any property owner that installs a solar power system enters into a billing arrangement with a utility that's called net energy metering. And what net energy metering is it's an annualized billing arrangement. So when someone installs a solar power system, they no longer pay for their power on a monthly basis. Rather, they pay annually. And over that year period, for any energy that is put onto the grid, the solar producer receives full retail credit for that power.
So that's a sweet deal for the homeowner or the business owner that's putting solar on to take advantage of that net metering credit. But I understand that's going away. Can you tell us when?
Yeah, well, sort of. The net metering cap, there's a cap on the amount of net energy metered systems that we can have in each utility territory. That's 5% of the aggregate peak demand on the local utility grid. Mm-hmm. And SDG&E is the first utility in the state of California that's going to be hitting its cap. We anticipate that the cap will hit sometime between September and December of 2015. However, because there's going to be an unprecedented surge in demand for solar, it is likely that it will happen even before then.
Yeah, so to be safe, people should get in, what, this spring, this summer, to make sure that they lock that in?
Yeah, we're telling our customers that are interested in installing a solar power system that they definitely want to sign up before May of 2015, just because the typical installation backlog under normal market conditions is 120 days.
It's liable to be longer with everybody rushing to get these credits.
Exactly.
Now, If you do get in under that window, then you're grandfathered in with the net metering, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So anyone that's already installed a solar power system is protected, and anybody that installs before the net metering cap is hit is also protected. They're going to receive 20 years of grandfathering provisions.
Wow, so that's a really big deal.
Once net metering goes away or these caps are reached, is there any other kind of incentive on the horizon that the California Public Utilities Commission or the legislature is looking at?
Currently, there is not any additional solar incentives that are being considered at the California Public Utilities Commission.
Okay, so that's a big deal. Now, there's a second incentive that's also going away. Tell us about that at the federal level.
Yeah, so at the federal level, the federal tax credit pays for 30% of a solar project cost, which is the largest incentive that's available for any solar producer in the United States. The federal tax credit on the residential level is going to be eliminated completely in 2016. So the solar power system has to be installed and fully energized by the end of 2016 in order to capture that tax credit. And then for commercial property owners, the 30% tax credit is going to be reduced to 10% in 2016. So the incentive is going down.
Interesting. So obviously there's a big incentive for homeowners to get in as early as possible on that as well, and business owners too. The obvious question here is both the president and the governor, you know, the legislature in California have been saying that they want to see more alternative energy, more use of solar, more rooftops. We had the million solar roofs incentive not very long ago. So the big question is, why are they taking away these incentives? Are we looking at the power of the lobbying by the big utility industries, a monopoly here?
Yeah, I would definitely say that's a part of it. So this most recent legislation that was signed into effect surrounding net energy metering, AB 327, was pushed forward through the utility companies. So they definitely are applying as much pressure as possible. You know,
yeah,
the utilities in California have a 100-year-old monopoly business model where they've controlled the power supply. And so solar does sort of provide a threat that they're not used to. And
yeah, they're pushing for the big industrialized projects, the industrialization of the desert and the rural areas here with these massive scale wind farms and desert solar projects, as opposed to utility companies really don't like the rooftop solar because it takes away from their profit model, I would assume.
Yeah, the 33% renewable portfolio standard does qualify for utility-owned power. So 33% of their power does need to come from renewable sources, and they prefer to put it into the high desert so that they can sink assets into the ground and build transmission lines into.
Yeah, which are very profitable. They make something like 11 cents a mile, or a lot of money on those transmission lines that they can actually bill back to the ratepayers under California law. Now, if people don't like these changes, what can they do?
Well, on the federal level, there's a great opportunity to reach out to your local congressmen and representatives to let them know that you support solar and renewable energy and you want to see the continuous growth. The reality of the situation is the solar industry has been the fastest growing industry in the United States over the past 2 years. So there's so many benefits, whether it be job creation, declaring energy independence as a nation, and then also supporting a sustainable future for the next generation. So there's a lot of benefits in reaching out to your local representatives on the federal level to request the extension of the tax credit is definitely something that we as a company are trying to do, and we hope that solar supporters throughout the community will do as well.
Yeah. And listeners, if you've just tuned in, we are talking with Erica Johnson, who's the Director of Community Relations at Sullivan Solar Power here in San Diego. We've been talking about two big incentives for solar energy that are going to be going away. The federal tax credit is going to be ending in 2016, and the net metering, which is very favorable for ratepayers, there's a cap on that that's ending in the SDG&E territory perhaps as early as this year, and the recommendation is that if people want solar and they want to be assured that they can get grandfathered in for 20 years with the net metering, that they should do so before this summer. On a more positive note there, for those people that haven't looked at the pricing of solar in a long time, what's happened with it? I know it's dropped. How much has the price of solar itself dropped for residential and commercial?
Yeah, so over the past 6 years, pricing has dropped about almost 50%. The price of silicon has come down significantly. Mm-hmm. And then the increase in demand. In California, the California Solar Initiative program was very successful in that it increased the demand, and more property owners are going solar, especially in San Diego County. You drive down any street, you see a solar rooftop. So that's driven down prices as well. So the price of solar has come down significantly over the past 5 to 6 years.
And what is the payback period now from the time a person purchases the average solar system, say for your house? How long does it take before it pays for itself with the money you save on your utility bill?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is it depends. So now there's so many financing options that are available for solar producers where you don't have to come up with any money up front to install a solar project.
A PACE program.
PACE or lease or PPA. And actually even we have a partnership with the San Diego Metropolitan Credit Union. So the banks are getting involved to finance these systems where property owners don't have to come up with any money up front and they have a monthly payment that's lower than what they're currently paying on electricity. So with those financing options, you're saving money from day one with nothing out of pocket. If you were to purchase the system with cash or purchase it outright up front, you're looking at about a 6 to 9 year full return on investment.
Yeah, and that's currently right now with including these incentives that are about to go away.
Correct, including the 30% federal tax credit.
Very good. Well, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners here today on KNSJ?
I think that just now we're seeing a really great time for people that have ever considered going solar. There's definitely a larger sense of urgency than we've seen in the past with solar becoming not as favorable as current rules and policies provide. So other than that, I thank you for your time and having me in today.
Well, you're very welcome. And certainly we should also add that going solar is a good way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as well for those that are relying on conventional power or gas or something else, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in San Diego, there's no better place in the entire country to be energy independent where we have sunshine year long.
That's right. You may not need nuclear or gas-powered power plants if everybody would go solar.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
The new Native American Student Alliance, or NASA, at Cuyamaca College hosted the first annual Cuyamaca Powwow. Teca Sosi, vice president of the student organization and coordinator of the event, said, "Our goal is to share the rich heritage of our region's Native culture." Powwow is a meeting of American Indians for social and ceremonial purposes. There's dancing, gift-giving, singing, drumming, fry bread, Native crafts, and friends, old and new. One thing special about this powwow is, as Master of Ceremonies John Dawson said, this is for the love of the culture because there are no big money prizes, as there often are at powwows around the nation for the best regalia and dancing. Everyone stands when the Eagle staff enters the arena. There is great respect for the Native American warriors who are veterans of the United States military service. More Native Americans serve in the military than any other ethnic group. Master of Ceremonies John Dawson is well known from his 30 years of participation in Native American community and singing ceremonial songs from the time of his grandfather. Dawson is Apache from the San Carlos Reservation in Arizona, where sacred Apache land is under siege. He understands the importance of tribal culture and tradition. Arena Director Shigo Yellowhorse was born in the Native American community of Los Angeles. He kept the friendly dance competition lively. Headman Nico Black Eagle Phoenix from the Tohono O'odham people of the desert turned in an athletic performance. Headwoman Jackie Galissi Davidson is a student at Cuyamaca College. Jackie is Pima, Apache, and Tohono. She's the president of the Native American Student Alliance, which was revived last spring with a Native American graduation ceremony. All eyes were on young Zion J. Fox, the fifth grader from Los Alamitos Elementary School, who was named as the head young man dancer. His grass dancing was mesmerizing. Grass dancing comes from Missouri tribes where the prairie grass grows tall. The dancers tell stories of hunting or battle. Head young woman Damaris Ibarra's mother is a member of the Tule River Band of Yokuts. Damaris has been dancing with the Soaring Eagles for 7 years, and when she danced the fancy shawl dance, she seemed to be floating above the floor. The event was blessed to have two wonderful and powerful drum companies, the Cali Boys from Los Angeles and Hale & Company from Oak Springs, Arizona. The northern and southern styles are different, but both have great power. Head gourd dancer Richard James Van Dyke is a 20-year veteran of the U.S. Navy. Richard is a member of the Golden State Gourd Society. Staff carrier Richard DeCrane is Navajo and Crow and a decorated war veteran who was renamed by his great-grandfather to become the warrior who has returned to his people. A special treat was the Kumeyaay bird singers, a vital element in the local Native American social structure. Bird singers start early in life to learn group singing. Everyone enjoys the men's fancy dancers with the warrior regalia and athleticism. All the arena dances tell stories of battle, hunting, or adventure. The prairie chicken dance is a favorite, but the highlight for me was the jingle dress dance from the Great Lakes Anishinaabe Chippewa from Minnesota, my tribe. The fancy shawl dancers' feet barely touch the floor as they dance mostly backwards with high leaps and toe tappings and twirls. It was breathtaking to watch. The Native American Student Alliance has much to be proud. The first Kuyamaka powwow was a wonderful success, accomplishing the purpose of sharing, educating, and immersion into our rich Native American ways. Tech Associates assures me that next year's Kuyamaka powwow will be even bigger and better. This has been Leon Thompson with the Tribal Beat Report on East County Magazine.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Today, we are resuming our conversation with Richard Penick, the former president and CEO, founding member, and now the media coordinator of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. Dick Penick, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Helen. I'm glad to be here again with you. It's certainly my pleasure.
Last time, we learned about the size and operations of the Railway Museum. Our listeners can actually Google Pacific Southwest Railway, some variation of those words, and find you. But what's the main phone number?
The main phone number is area code 619-465-PSRM. That's 7776 on the dial.
I'm going to repeat that. It's 619-465-7776. Gosh, that's patriotic.
It is.
Sounds like the American Revolution. And it sounds like it was all the way out in Campo. You really have written the book on how to restore old trains and make them accessible to the public. Now, perhaps your most famous operation is that living history component, those weekend train rides at Campo. You are there as a conductor and locomotive engineer in full regalia, I might add. How much is a ticket, and do you still travel from Campo to Tecate?
We have weekend-only trains. We recommend that people check our website, psrm.org, to make sure of the schedule before they make the drive out there. It is a long way from San Diego, but certainly we feel it's worth the ride. We do not currently go to Tecate, and the reason is there is a railroad tunnel just over the international border on the Mexican side that burned and collapsed Christmas Day 2009. And since that time, the tunnel has not been repaired, and our monthly trips to Tecate had to be temporarily curtailed. So currently, we confine all of our operations and our special activities to the U.S. side of the border, between the border and Campo.
Why is the Campo train ride sometimes called the Polar Express?
Well, like all nonprofits, we do need to protect our bottom line, and we have many public activities, special activities during the year. The biggest one being our Santa train in the Christmas season. The first train runs the day after Thanksgiving, and we run 12 to 15 of those on consecutive weekends through the Christmas season. It is extremely popular, sold out every year, and as a matter of fact, Helen, members can buy their tickets for it right now.
Wonderful. Parents out there, get ready. Richard, at the dawn of the railroad, nobody had a union. There were no OSHA rules, occupational safety and health. So what were some of the dangers to, say, a brakeman on the railroad or another worker?
Interesting you ask about the brakeman, because on the railroad, particularly in the early days, that was one of the most dangerous occupations in train service. Now, even then, as now, you could get a job on the railroad in the office and never have to worry about ice and snow and sleet and storm. But the brakeman's job, before the days of air brakes, required that the brakeman, and they were all men in those days, had to ride the tops of the freight cars on a freight train in all weather, and they lost many of them in service. So there was generally always a job available, a job opening for brakemen, because the turnover was pretty high. It was a very hazardous occupation. Now, the passenger brakeman had it a little easier. He rode inside the passenger coaches normally with a conductor, so that wasn't quite so bad. But the freight brakeman on the freight trains, pretty horrible job.
Now, when people were riding the rails, which is the subject of poetry and song and folk music and all of the lore of the 1930s, really, what was that like for somebody to ride the rails? Where are you?
You mean like a hobo?
Yes.
Well,
In a word.
There were two different types of illegal rail riders, hobos and bums. Bums in those days had the same connotation it has today. Hobos sometimes were of a different cut. Sometimes they were riding the train illegally, but sort of looked the other way officially, because they were searching for work. They were moving from one workplace, one seasonal workplace possibly, to another, and many of the railroads often cut them a little slack and would not necessarily kick them off. They were all lumped under the term hobo, but there were differences. The bums often spent their evenings in jail when they were caught, whereas the hobos were, if you can say, maybe a somewhat higher echelon of itinerant society, shall we say.
Dick, the classic movie image is of a group of hobos. These are lonely guys in felt hats who go and offer to chop wood for a sandwich. They're all together in an empty freight car. They jump off at different points. Are we saying the wino, some poor tragic guy, is literally under that freight car? If we're riding the rails, we're so close to the rails, we're almost on them. Is that what that phrase means? It's a scary thing.
Well, not necessarily, but certainly there have been a lot of fatalities by bums, winos, others that aren't supposed to be on the property, going to sleep in a drunken stupor on a railroad track, which can be a very fatal exercise. And it happens often on the Mexican side of the border, particularly at night. It even happens on the U.S. side. It's an unfortunate part of railroad operation. There are people that don't watch the crossing signs when they're crossing railroad tracks in their car or on foot. And in spite of all the warning signs and all of the measures the railroads try to take to promote safety, there are still tragedies.
Exactly. Richard, you have been intimately involved with railroads for all of your life, long ago and far away, as a carefree, wind-in-your-hair young man. Didn't you ride the rails? Have you had personal experience?
I did, and I do. Even in my senior years, I continue to have experiences that I cherish very highly. I will tell you that I have never had professional railroad experience. I get asked that question a lot. But I did try to get a job with the railroad in Oakland, California, back in the mid-1950s, right after I got out of high school, because I wanted to become a fireman on a steam locomotive. And unfortunately, the railroad was getting rid of its steam locomotives at the time, and they wrote me back a Dear John letter saying, well, we're sorry, but we've laid off most of our firemen because we don't have a need for them anymore. And I always look back on those days and wonder if, should I have continued with trying to get a railroad career.
Were you hand-firing a coal-burning?
No, that was on an oil-burning locomotive. It would have been had I got the job. But I had that opportunity many years later when we founded the museum. But you asked about some other adventures that I have had over the years, and those have been many, particularly with regard to trains. And I had one, and I have to tell you up front, Helen, that this was strictly illegal. Do not encourage anybody to do this. It is strictly forbidden and against the law. But I was a young, headstrong, adventurous kid in those days, and I and others decided to hop a freight train on the railroad that we currently operate on, and we were going to take this ride through Carrizo Gorge and just have a ball. So we encamped ourselves on a flat car in a freight train, and we were coming back from El Centro in late afternoon, and there are 17 tunnels just in the 11 miles of the Carrizo Gorge section. And the first tunnel is protected by an overhead structure called a telltale. Basically, it's just a wooden framework with ropes with knots on the end of them hanging down about 3 feet below the top of this gantry. And it's designed to warn a trainman on top of a car that there's a tunnel or limited head clearance coming up. So should they be facing the wrong way, it warns them that you better duck because there's something coming up that might take the upper part of your torso off. So I was facing the wrong way when we were coming up to the first tunnel and enjoying the view and the fresh air in my hair. And all of a sudden, this telltale hit me in the back. And I immediately flattened on top of the car, and had I not done so, the tunnel was coming up in about an eighth of a mile, and I would have been a dead person. So it was
Richard,
very hazardous.
Thank you for sharing that. And dear listeners, this does fall under the heading of don't try this at home, unless you are the body double for Sean Connery. I think we've all seen somebody, or Steve McQueen, fall to the roof, and suddenly there's a tunnel. And the audience is aghast. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Helen.
Dick Pennick, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing the lore, some of the lore. There's obviously much more from the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. We didn't even get into the archives, and I know you have a big, big archive of precious material. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
This is a public service announcement from the City of El Cajon. The City of El Cajon Teen Coalition is seeking nominations for its Youth of the Year Award, recognizing those teens who show leadership abilities serving their community in El Cajon. Final selections will be based on dedication, commitment beyond what may be required by school, and demonstrated impact on those served. If you know a youth who has gone the extra mile to improve the quality of life in our community, you are invited to send in a nomination. To qualify for the reward, the nominee must be a resident living in the City of El Cajon and enrolled in grades 6 through 12. Honors will be awarded for services that occurred in 2014. And nominees cannot be current members of the Teen Coalition. Nominations must be returned to the El Cajon Recreation Department by March 6th. Two middle school and two high school students will be chosen for the Youth of the Year Awards, which will be presented at an El Cajon City Council meeting in April. A perpetual plaque will also be displayed in the lobby at City Hall. For more information, call the City's Recreation Department at 619-441-1754.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.